Chapter 81. Hark you, chicket, screamed out Tagrag, next time look to your head. And next time, sure enough, each aimed at the head of the other. Tagrag's spear hit the right place, for it carried off the Baron's helmet, plume, rose wreath and all, but his excellency hit truer still, his lance took Tagrag on the neck, and sent him to the ground like a stone. He's won, says Jemmy, waving her handkerchief. Jemimran fainted, Lady Blanche screamed, and I felt so sick that I thought I should drop. All the company were in an uproar. Only the Baron looked calm, and bowed very gracefully, and kissed his hand to Jemmy, when, all of a sudden, a Jewish-looking man springing over the barrier, and followed by three more, rushed towards the Baron. Eep the gate, Bob! He hollows out. Aran, I arrest you, at the suit of Samuel Levison, for, but he never said for what, shouting out, aha! And apristy, and I don't know what, his excellency drew his sword, dug his spurs into his horse, and was over the poor bailiff, and off before another word. He had threatened to run through one of the bailiff's followers, Mr. Stubbs, only that gentleman made way for him, and when we took up the bailiff, and brought him round by the aid of a little brandy and water, he told us all. Had a writ against him, Mr. Cox, but I didn't want to spoil sport, and, beshittish, I didn't know him until they knocked off his steel cap. ... Here was a pretty business. Overboarded and underlodged. We had no great reason to brag of our tournament at Tuggeridgeville. But, after all, it was better than the turnout at Kilblaz's, where poor Lord Haydoundery went about in a black velvet dressing gown, and the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte appeared in a suit of armor and silk stockings, like Mr. Pell's friend in Pickwick. We, having employed the gentleman from Astley's Amphitheatre, had some decent sport for our money. We never heard a word from the Baron, who had so distinguished himself by his horsemanship, and had knocked down, and very justly, Mr. Nab, the bailiff, and Mr. Stubbs, his man, who came to lay hands upon him. My sweet Jemmy seemed to be very low in spirits after his departure, and a sad thing it is to see her in low spirits. On days of illness she no more minds giving Jemimran a box on the ear, or sending a plate of muffins across a table at poor me, than she does taking her tea. Jemmy, I say, was very low in spirits. But, one day, I remember it was the day after Captain Higgins called, and said he had seen the Baron at Bowlin, she vowed that nothing but change of air would do her good, and declared that she should die, unless she went to the seaside in France. I knew what this meant, and that I might as well attempt to resist her, as to resist her gracious majesty in Parliament assembled. So I told the people, to pack up the things, and took four places on board the Grand Turk steamer for Bowlin. The traveling carriage, which, with Jemmy's 37 boxes and my carpet bag, was pretty well loaded, was sent on board the night before. And we, after breakfasting in Portland Place, little did I think it was the, but, oh, never mind, went down to the custom house in the other carriage, followed by a hackney coach and a cab, with the servants, and 14 bandboxes and trunks more, which were to be wanted by my dear girl in the journey. The road down Cheapside and Thames Street need not be described. We saw the monument, a memento of the wicked popish massacre of St. Bartholomew, why erected here I can't think, as St. Bartholomew is in Smithfield. We had a glimpse of Billingsgate, and of the mansion house, where we saw the 22-shilling coal smoke coming out of the chimneys, and were landed at the custom house in safety. I felt melancholy, for we were going among a people of swindlers, as all Frenchmen are thought to be, and, besides not being able to speak the language, leaving our own dear country and honest countrymen. 14 porters came out, and each took a package with the greatest civility, calling Jemmy her ladyship, and me your honor, eh, and your honoring, and my ladyshipping even my man, and the maid in the cab. I somehow felt all over quite melancholy at going away. Here, my fine fellow, says I to the coachman, who was standing very respectful, holding his hat in one hand and Jemmy's jewel case in the other. Here, my fine chap, says I, here's 6 shillings for you, for I did not care for the money. 6 what? Says he. 6 shillings, fellow, shrieks Jemmy, and twice as much as your fare. Feller, marm, says this insolent coachman. Eller yourself, marm. Do you think I may going to kill my horses, and break my precious back, and bust my carriage, and carry you, and your kids, and your traps for 6 hog? And with this the monster dropped his hat, with my money in it, and doubling his fist put it so very near my nose, that I really thought he would have made it bleed. Why, fare's 18 shillings, says he, ain't it? Ask any of these gentlemen. Why, it ain't more than 17 and 6, says one of the 14 porters. But if the gentleman is a gentleman, he can't give no less than a suffering anyhow. I wanted to resist, and Jemmy screamed like a Turk. But, holloa, says one. Hats the row, says another. Dub up, roars a third. And I don't mind telling you, in confidence, that I was so frightened, that I took out the sovereign and gave it. My man and Jemmy's maid had disappeared by this time. They always do when there's a robbery or a row going on. I was going after them. Top, Mr. Ferguson, pipes a young gentleman of about 13, with a red livery waistcoat that reached to his ankles, and every variety of button, pin, string, to keep it together. Top, Mr. F, says he, taking a small pipe out of his mouth, and don't forge it, the cabman. What's your fare, my lad? Says I, why, let's see, yes ho, my fare's 7 and 30 and 8 pence exactly. The 14 gentlemen holding the luggage here burst out and laughed very rudely indeed, and the only person who seemed disappointed was, I thought, the hackney coachman. Hi, you rascal, says Jemmy, laying hold of the boy, do you want more than the coachman? Don't rascal me, marm, shrieks the little chap in return. What's the coach to me? Vi, you may go in an omnibus for 6 pence if you like. Why don't you go and bus it, marm? Why did you call my cab, marm? Why am I to come 40 mile, from Scarlet Street, Potland Street, Potland Plus, and not get my fare, marm? Come, give me a suffering and a half, and don't keep my hoss a-waiting all day. This speech, which takes some time to write down, was made in about the 5th part of a second. And, at the end of it, the young gentleman hurled down his pipe, and, advancing towards Jemmy, doubled his fist, and seemed to challenge her to fight. My dearest girl now turned from red to be as pale as white Windsor, and fell into my arms. What was I to do? I called Ollisman, but a policeman won't interfere in Thames Street. Robbery is licensed there. What was I to do? Oh! My heart beats with paternal gratitude when I think of what my tug did. As soon as this young cab chap put himself into a fighting attitude, Master Tuggeridge Cox, who had been standing by laughing very rudely, I thought Master Tuggeridge Cox, I say, flung his jacket suddenly into his mama's face, the brass buttons made her start, and recovered her a little, and, before we could say a word, was in the ring in which we stood, formed by the porters, 9 Orangemen and women, I don't know how many newspaper boys, hotel cats, and old clothesmen, and, whirling about 2 little white fists in the face of the gentleman in the red waistcoat, who brought up a great pair of black ones to bear on the enemy, was engaged in an instant. But law bless you, Tug hadn't been at Richmond School for nothing, and milled away 1, 2, right and left like a little hero as he is, with all his dear mother's spirit in him. First came a crack which sent a long dusky white hat, that looked damp and deep like a well, and had a long black crepe rag twisted round it. First came a crack which sent this white hat spinning over the gentleman's cab, and scattered among the crowd a vast number of things which the cabman kept in it, such as a ball of string, a piece of candle, a comb, a whiplash, a little warbler, a slice of bacon, and see, the cabman seemed sadly ashamed of this display, but Tug gave him no time. Another blow was planted on his cheekbone, and a third, which hit him straight on the nose, sent this rude cabman straight down to the ground. "Bravo, my lord!" shouted all the people around. "I won't have no more, thank yer," said the little cabman, gathering himself up. "I've us over my fare, fill yer, and let me get away." "What's your fare now, you cowardly little thief?" says Tug. "Vi, then, 2 and 8 pence, says he. "Oh, long, you know it is." And 2 and 8 pence he had, and everybody applauded Tug, and hissed the cab boy, and asked Tug for something to drink. We heard the packet bell ringing, and all run down the stairs to be in time. I now thought our troubles would soon be over. Mine were, very nearly so, in one sense at least. For after Mrs. Cox and Jim Imran, and Tug, and the maid, and valet, and valuables had been handed across, it came to my turn. I had often heard of people being taken up by a plank, but seldom of their being set down by one. Just as I was going over, the vessel rode off a little, the board slipped, and down I soused into the water. You might have heard Mrs. Cox's shriek as far as Gravesend. It rung in my ears as I went down, all grieved at the thought of leaving her a disconsolate widow. Well, up I came again, and caught the brim of my beaver hat, though I have heard that drowning men catch at straws. I floated, and hoped to escape by hook or by crook. And, luckily, just then, I felt myself suddenly jerked by the waistband of my whites, and found myself hauled up in the air at the end of a boat hook, to the sound of, "Eho! Yeho! Yehoy! Yehoy!" And so I was dragged aboard. I was put to bed, and had swallowed so much water that it took a very considerable quantity of brandy to bring it to a proper mixture in my inside. In fact, for some hours I was in a very deplorable state. Notice to quit. Well, we arrived at Bowlin, and Jemmy, after making inquiries, right and left, about the Baron, found that no such person was known there, and being bent, I suppose, at all events, on marrying her daughter to a lord, she determined to set off for Paris, where, as he had often said, he possessed a magnificent hotel, he called it. And I remember Jemmy being mightily indignant at the idea, but hotel, we found afterwards, means only a house in French, and this reconciled her. Need I describe the road from Bowlin to Paris, or need I describe that capital itself? Suffice it to say, that we made our appearance there, at Eurus's hotel, as became the family of Cox Tuggeridge, and saw everything worth seeing in the metropolis in a week. It nearly killed me, to be sure, but, when you're on a pleasure party in a foreign country, you must not mind a little inconvenience of this sort. Well, there is, near the city of Paris, a splendid road and row of trees, which I don't know why is called the Champs-Élysées, or Elysian Fields, in French. Others, I have heard, call it the Chandelierie, but mine I know to be the correct pronunciation. In the middle of this Champs-Élysées is an open space of ground, and a tent where, during the summer, Mr. Franconi, the French Ashley, performs with his horses and things. As everybody went there, and we were told it was quite the thing, Jemmy agreed that we should go too, and go we did. It's just like Ashley's. There's a man just like Mr. Pidicombe, who goes round the ring in a hussy dress, cracking a whip. There are a dozen Miss Wolfords, who appear like Polish princesses, Dehannas, Sultanas, Kachuchas, and heaven knows what. There's the fat man, who comes in with the 23 dresses on, and turns out to be a living skeleton. There's the clowns, the sawdust, the white horse, that dances a hornpipe, The candle stuck in hoops, just as in our own dear country. My dear wife, in her very finest clothes, with all the world looking at her, was really enjoying this spectacle which doesn't require any knowledge of the language, seeing that the dumb animals don't talk it, when there came in, presently, the great Polish act of the Sarmatian horse tamer, on 8 steeds, which we were all of us longing to see. The horse tamer, to music 20 miles an hour, rushed in on 4 of his horses, leading the other 4, and scurried round the ring. You couldn't see him for the sawdust, but everybody was delighted, and applauded like mad. Presently, you saw there were only 3 horses in front. He had slipped one more between his legs, another followed, and it was clear that the consequences would be fatal if he admitted any more. The people applauded more than ever, and when, at last, 7 and 8 were made to go in, not wholly, but sliding dexterously in and out, with the others, so that you did not know which was which, the house, I thought, would come down with applause, and the Sarmatian horse tamer bowed his great feathers to the ground. At last the music grew slower, and he cantered leisurely round the ring, bending, smirking, seesawing, waving his whip, and laying his hand on his heart, just as we have seen the Ashley's people do. But fancy our astonishment when, suddenly, this Sarmatian horse tamer, coming round with his 4 Paraday canter, and being opposite our box, gave a start, and a hop, which made all his horses stop stock still at an instant. Albert! Screamed my dear Jemmy Colin Albert. Baba Baron! The Sarmatian looked at her for a minute, and turning head over heels, 3 times, bolted suddenly off his horses, and away out of our sight. It was His Excellency the Baron de Punter. Jemmy went off in a fit as usual, and we never saw the Baron again, but we heard, afterwards, that Punter was an apprentice of Franconi's, and had run away to England, thinking to better himself, and had joined Mr. Richardson's army. But Mr. Richardson, and then London, did not agree with him, and we saw the last of him as he sprung over the barriers at the Tuggeridgeville tournament. Well, Jemimrin, says Jemmy, in a fury, you shall marry Tagrag, and if I can't have a baroness for a daughter, at least you shall be a baronet's lady. Poor Jemimrin only sighed. She knew it was of no use to remonstrate. Paris grew dull to us after this, and we were more eager than ever to go back to London. For what should we hear, but that monster, Tuggeridge, of the city old Tug's black son, forsooth, was going to contest Jemmy's claim to the property, and had filed I don't know how many bills against us in Chancery. Hearing this, we set off immediately, and we arrived at Bowlin, and set off in that very same Grand Turk which had brought us to France. If you look in the bills, you will see that the steamers leave. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.